thank you for joining me, spending a little time. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. Bill Burns, New York Times best-selling author, magazine publisher, and New York literary publishing agent, who has written and edited over 25 books and encyclopedias in the fields of human behavior, true crime, current affairs, history, psychology, business, computing, and the paranormal, will be joining me. We're going to be talking about The Day After Roswell. It's being released in audio form, and this is coming up for the 70th anniversary of the crash at Roswell. We'll talk about some of the new findings. We'll also be talking about Edison and Tesla and their race to try to create a telephone to the dead. We'll be discussing that tomorrow on the Best in Overnight Talk Radio. I'll be back again with you mid-June as well, and we've got some great topics. I'm going to be lining up a true crime evening of Saturdays, and this show you're definitely going to want to tune in for. We have a wrongfully convicted story that takes twists and turns that are right up Rod Serling's alleyway. It is a crime that has unbelievable twists and ends with a curse that is still taking lives today. You've got to hear it to believe it. And we'll also be talking to the filmmaker, the writer, director, and producer of I Am Jane Doe, which is available on Netflix now. Get a chance to watch it. It is a frightening look at an unbelievable phenomena that's taking place in the United States right now. Educate yourself about it. And we'll be talking more about that in depth when we return for that in June. So I hope you'll join me. Tonight, we're talking with David Elkington for this hour. We'll also be taking your phone calls. We talk about the Jordan codices. We'll talk about the mystery behind it and what happened when he was recently in Jordan and detained for 30 days. What's happened since he's returned? We'll talk about that right after this. We are back. This is the Best in Overnight Talk Radio, Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, sitting in for George Norrie. I'm Dave Schrader. The Jordan Codices are an ancient set of 70 lead tablets that could change the world's view of biblical history. Scholar and Egyptologist David Elkington has focused on proving the authenticity of these artifacts. Just back from Jordan, Elkington is with me tonight to discuss how he was detained by authorities and why he believes the Jordanian government wants to suppress all knowledge of what could be a huge game changer. We'll also have some open phone lines, take some of your calls here near the bottom of the hour. So has anything happened since you've returned?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, beyond all the death threats and the threats of being silenced, etc., we both of us feel that actually we really are onto something, because obviously when somebody like an official organization, the Department of Antiquities in Jordan, threatens you in such a way, you think, gosh, we really have discovered something really quite impressive, something quite amazing. So we're not going to be silenced. But one thing that we have discovered is that we found out that in July 2016, July last year, that Salem Al-Shtafat, one of the worst of the bloggers against the codices, he had himself been convicted by a New York court for smuggling a mummy from Egypt to Dubai, and then on to New York, where he and his gang were caught before it was sold at auction. In the indictment between 2008 and 2009, he and his cohorts engaged in a scheme to smuggle cultural antiquities into the United States. Hmm. And this activity was actually reported in an enormous amount of publications, including National Geographic magazine. But what was curious was that he was only given a little slap on the wrist. And, you know, this obviously was not that much of a deterrent to stop the lucrative activity of smuggling.
Right.
And, of course, it seems to me now that he's moved on now to the subject of the codices.
But why was he only given a slap on the wrist? I mean, this seems like a pretty big deal to be involved in. How is he getting away with that? You know, that seems like
what it comes down to nowadays. Right. I think that is all to do with money. This guy is a multimillionaire, and he's seeking to actually protect his investment. I think this is what it all comes down to. The things that he deals with are worth a lot of money, and this is all that they're interested in. And this is part of the problem. People are putting money over understanding. You know, we in England this week, where there was a bomb outrage in Manchester, it was shocking. 22 young people were killed. And, you know, there's a lot of cry in Britain at the moment for action to be taken, and some extremists are actually blaming the Muslim community here, you know, and that's awful, because it was the Muslim community that reported the bomber to the security services, who unfortunately didn't follow up on those calls. Now, this is interesting because our friends in Jordan are Muslims. They are welcoming the codices. They want there to be understanding. They want knowledge of these things to be out there in the wide world. They want people to understand and have knowledge of where we come from, what these things represent, what they say. We need more information on this subject, not less. We need more understanding, not less. And smuggling activities just aid ignorance. They aid the idea of suppression. They aid the fact that information and knowledge is hidden.
On the other side, David, if I could ask, I mean, if it hadn't been for the smuggling, those codices would have never gotten into your hands to begin with, correct?
that's a good point. It's very ironic, isn't it, that actually the codices are much safer in the hands of the Bedouin Hassan Saida in Israel than they are actually with the Department of Antiquities in Jordan. I mean, this is extremely embarrassing for the Jordanian government, and, you know, in the light of Munsa Jamhawi's threat to actually bomb the Jordan Museum in Amman, and they should take action, because, you know, we're going to be transcribing these comments onto our Facebook page very shortly.
Right.
And you know, this is really embarrassing, and it's embarrassing for those who are behind the DOA and creating the appointments of people like Munta, you know. And I'm afraid to say a lot of it is down to, you know, Western interests, because, of course, you know, coming back to the subject of Mr. Al-Shtefat, you know, he was even subsequently invited onto Jordanian TV and introduced as a prominent and successful antiquities dealer. I mean, you've got to ask yourself, why is this guy being protected? Why is he being promoted even?
Right.
You know, are you behind this? What is their interest in doing so? You know,
right.
Even his cousin, Dr. Yunus Al-Shtefat of Moth University in southern Jordan, has also been campaigning against the codices and blogging, and has been he's also connected with some of the university scholars who seem to be abetting him in his deals. We had the same thing in Israel with Oded Galan and the James Ossuary, and the fact that he was supported by certain scholars from Western Europe who were actually paid, you know, for their involvement, which is, again, you know, a very corrupt practice. This goes very, very deep indeed, and it's basically to do with money and profit. Money over understanding and knowledge.
Are you then suggesting that ACOR and the Department of Antiquities are working in tandem with these smugglers?
You might think that, but I couldn't possibly say. But from the evidence we've seen, Al-Shtefat is definitely the ringleader behind the whole campaign of suppression. But who it is who's colluding with him and supporting him is all the more shocking.
So where have the codices gone now?
Now, that's a question that should be put to Dr. Barbara Porter, the director of ACOR, because obviously this is a story about big business and big money. And Al-Shtefat, you know, a millionaire looking to maximize his fortune at the expense of Jordan's history. And, you know, we've seen with our own eyes examples of Jordan's heritage being ransacked. We've had reports from people in villages all over Jordan where things are discovered. Lorries turn up. People in the night, they dig these things out, statues and other antiquities, etc. They're loaded onto the lorries, and then, of course, they disappear into the night. You know, this Jordan is a phenomenally wealthy place in terms of antiquities. It is just extraordinary how much there is there. But the sheer volume of traffic that is going across the border for others to make profit from is simply staggering. And here is another shocking statistic, something which your viewers should know. Fundamentalist Christians are directly and indirectly funding ISIL, the terrorist organization responsible for so many atrocities in Europe, and, of course, you know, with their connections to Al-Qaeda, because fundamentally what is happening is those antiquities are going through the London auction markets, where they are being purchased by fundamentalists and others, And that money given for those antiquities is going all the way back into the pockets of those who dug them up in areas such as Palmyra, Syria, Iraq, and some to a large degree in Jordan. And the money involved is staggering. I believe that about 3 years ago, it was approximately £80 million. That's probably about $110 million actually went into the hands of the terrorists simply through the sale of antiquities in London markets. And of course, the attempt to sell them through New York markets into the bargain. This is really quite staggering.
Hmm. Do you have any idea where the codices at the Department of Antiquities might have gone?
Well, in 2015, there was a break-in in one of their storage units. Windows were forced open, and yet the break-in was never reported. The Department of Antiquities insisted that nothing was stolen, yet they're now claiming that they have no codices. They don't have any at all. Yet, when we were there to brief the director, Ziad Al-Saad, in May 2011, he asked us to choose a codex, a temporary loan, to bring back to the UK to have tested and analysed, which we did. But in return, we gave them a couple of lead tablets that we felt it was our duty to return to Jordan because it's Jordanian property.
Right.
And we actually raised this issue with the Department of Antiquities on this last visit, and they denied that we'd ever done such a thing. So where have the codices gone? This is what we need to start asking, not just the Jordan government, but we need to start asking the director of ACOR herself, because she'll know. I'm quite convinced of it, because they're such a large and influential organization. I cannot believe that they would not know. They simply must have the answers, and I think it's time that they were asked.
Why have no more translations been undertaken with these codices?
Well, in the light of what I've just told you with death threats and the threats to scholarship, with scholars being told that they, you know, if they get involved, they'll have their pensions removed, they'll have their jobs taken away, you can understand it. I mean, people get very afraid of these things, you know, and this is the key issue. We've had quite a bit of translation done by various professors that, you know, scholars, you know, they've held back out of respect for Jordan, and they've been waiting for the Jordanians to make the appropriate announcements, you know, by the appropriate authorities. And you know, secondly, many of the scholars supporting the codices are doing so tacitly, as they are so afraid. But in fact, you know, Professor Philip Davies, Margaret Barker, Professor Ziad Al-Saad have all come under attack for publicly supporting the codices, as well as others. So, you know, added to this, we've got the bibliobloggers who have been so vicious that it's scared off other more distinguished scholars from making their findings public. I even had to take legal proceedings against another scholar, Samuel Zinner, for slander and unfounded accusations in an article he wrote and published on academia.edu last December that was masquerading as an academic paper, but was actually nothing more than a spiteful rant, which was swiftly removed by the website monitors, thank goodness, on the insistence of my lawyers. You know, and it's just this undignified behavior in academe, especially online, that's also led to others being put off. You know, the true scholars, the ones who truly understand, you know, their subjects, the ones who could truly make the breakthroughs on this, they've kept a silent counsel, and they're very wise to do so. They've stayed in the background, whilst, you know, at the other end we have the very loud voices who don't really know that much, saying, oh, they're fake, they're this, they're that. And yet, as I said at the beginning of the program, not a single one of them has ever inquired of us for data or analysis regarding the 15 separate laboratory tests performed on the codices, all of which have confirmed their antiquity.
Why do you think it is, though, that you've got such an important find with the Jordan codices, and they've received publicity around the world, with the exception of the USA, the UK, and Jordan? There are enough interested parties that it should break somewhere besides Coast to Coast AM in American media.
You'd have thought so. We've been staggered at the campaign of suppression, and, you know, we've been diplomatic for the past 8 years on this issue, but we've decided finally to go public here on Coast to Coast, because we are in danger of losing something that is going to change the way in which we look at the origins, not just of Christianity, but of Islam and Judaism. We're, this is something that could actually help us to understand each other, to give us knowledge, to actually walk hand in hand against extremism. But instead, it's fallen into the hands of extremists, and it's tragic. It's exactly the same as the Dead Sea Scrolls back in the 1940s. We've got a campaign of suppression, and it's a scandal that's going to build and build and build. And it's just tragic. And unfortunately, it's not uncommon in academe. It's something that happens on a fairly regular basis. I mean, one Oxford scholar, Peter Toneman, who's a classicist and not even a biblical scholar, dismissed the entire collection of codices on the basis of one low-resolution photograph back in 2010. He said he would stake his reputation on the entire hoard being fake. And we've since proven him completely and absolutely wrong. I wonder if he's resigned yet. This is par for the course.
What has been the overall reaction to the codices by various churches that know about this?
Well, surprisingly enough, the Catholic Church have been very, very supportive indeed, which is really great. They are very much on board with this and want to know more. And we're in discussions with prelates there at the present time to further the cause. It's funny because Peter Toneman himself actually admitted to a colleague at Oxford that the reason that he actually made his statement against the codices was that actually he felt that the books were a threat to his faith, which is rather curious, given that the Catholic Church is now actually supporting the discovery. But by contrast to the Catholic Church, the Church of England here in the UK have been some of the worst. We've just been amazed at how they've actually sought, with very few exceptions, including the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Williams, with the exception of him and a few others, but the church has actually just sought to bury the entire subject. They've sought to actually have the codices suppressed. We've just been amazed. When we brought out the first of our books in 2014, the Bishop of St. Albans actually got in touch with our PR man and actually told him that he should stop work on this immediately. And the PR man, being a friend of this guy, just did exactly that. The book was not marketed, it wasn't publicized. It's quite remarkable, the lengths to which they're going. We're completely blown away by the level of suppression involved in this project. And we're also quite staggered by the fact that people seem to be afraid of knowledge. They seem to be afraid of truth. Yet these are the same people who actually go to Jesus, they go to the Bible, because they want to understand what the truth is. So there's a bit of a contradiction there.
Seems like it. We need to take a break. When we come back, David has a special invitation for Coast to Coast listeners. We'll talk about that, and we'll start taking your calls. I'm Dave Schrader, and you're listening to Coast AM. Thank you for joining me. If you'd like to meet George Norrie live, there are a couple of great opportunities coming up. Dan Heiser, Wagner Entertainment, presents Eat and Greet Luncheon Series at the Great Greek Restaurant in Sherman Oaks, California, June 27th from 2 to 4 p.m. You can meet George Norrie and Rich Martini, and you can get information and tickets by visiting coasttocoastam.com and clicking on George's tab. You'll find where he's going to be and what's going to be coming up. July 29th from 5 to 8 p.m., he's going to be at the Everett Theater in Everett, Washington. Radio to stage. You can enjoy the grand experience yourself with the Dan Heiser Wagner Entertainment bringing the world's number one late night radio show to the stage. So you can enjoy watching the host of Coast to Coast AM, Emmy Award winner George Norrie, interview some of today's brightest experts in the world of ufology, paranormal, conspiracy, and all things unexplained. It's a three-hour stage show that consists of interviews combined with video, music, and sometimes a little singing, which will create an unforgettable experience for theatergoers and fans of the hugely popular Coast to Coast AM radio show. You can get more tickets again by checking out the website. That's Saturday, July 29th, 2017, from 5 to 8 p.m. at the historic Everett Theater in Everett, Washington. Robert Felix, Sonia Grace, Mike Barra, and John Hogue will all be on hand with George Norrie. You can get information at coasttocoastam.com. I'm your host this evening, sitting in for George Norrie. I'm Dave Schrader. I'm the host of the best in paranormal talk radio, Beyond the Darkness. You can hear us 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, as we explore the strange and supernatural, along with my cohort and producer, Tim Dennis. We will talk about ghosts, UFOs, psychic phenomena, monsters, myths, and legends. And we do it with a lot of fun, so I hope you'll check it out. Go visit darknessradio.com, and you can find some of the shows streaming there. You'll get all the information on joining us. Or you can go directly to podcast1.com or iTunes and subscribe to Beyond the Darkness. You never have to miss another minute in the best of overnight talk radio and paranormal talk radio by following me right on the website. You'll see what dates I'll be on Coast to Coast AM and what we're going to be covering on our own show. All right, we've got with us David Elkington. And David, before the break, I made a mention, you have a special invite for Coast to Coast listeners. What would you like to do for them?
Yeah, I would like to say to all Coast to Coast listeners to look at our Jordan Codices community Facebook page. We'd like to offer all of you a free download of our book, What Are the Jordan Codices? In exchange, all we ask is that you like our page, and it would be great if you could recommend us to your friends. We cannot make this happen alone, and the more support we have behind us, the stronger our voice becomes, and the more influence we will have in order to overcome suppression and move forward with protecting the site and translating the codices. This will help the cause of understanding. We need, with the codices, to have proper and impartial debate. We need to have the involvement of all parties to create further understanding so that we can all walk forward together instead of seeing these things suppressed and then to see them disappear either into private collections or even being destroyed.
All right, so check it out, folks. Go to the Jordan Codices community Facebook page, and they'll offer you a free download of What Are the Jordan Codices? And again, all they ask is that you like the page and share it with your friends. Recommend that out. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and take your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM. We'll begin taking your calls momentarily. You can also email in any questions for me, for our guest, or for the next 2 hours of open lines. You can reach me, Dave at darknessradio.com. That's Dave at darknessradio.com. Joe from Massachusetts writes in and says, loves this topic. Can you please give us some insight on what the codices say? What are some of the translations that you've been able to get from them so far, David?
Yeah, we have translations from the Book of Daniel. Talking about the coming of the Messiah, we've got quotes from Proverbs 9:11. We've got under the menorah on the codices, the Jewish candlestick. There's a script in Paleo Hebrew that says that in Paleo Hebrew it says, "I will shine forth in righteousness, or I will walk uprightly," which is really, really interesting because, of course, you know, it's we think it's a definite reference to Jesus as the Messiah coming forth. It's quite fascinating. It's a quote also from Proverbs. We've also got quotes from elsewhere as well. We don't actually have New Testament quotes, which is obviously very interesting because, of course, the codices predate the New Testament. So if anybody's looking for quotes from the recognizable Gospels, then I'm afraid to say that they won't be there. But what we have in terms of the books being the oldest known Christian documents is the potential to understand quite how the Gospels were written, why they were written in the way they were, and of course from the milieu from which the Gospels emerged. It's deeply fascinating stuff. It's a very, very fascinating project. We've also discovered the name of Jesus and some of the apostles on the codices as well. The names of James, Peter, and John are mentioned. And this is very interesting. We've known about this for about the past 8 or 9 years. We haven't said much about it because we wanted to make sure that the codices themselves had been authenticated by scientists who have now proven them beyond any shadow of a doubt to be authentic and to be, you know, 2,000 years old and most likely dating back to the very early part of the Christian period. And as I say, research continues. We will continue to share it with you because the world needs to know what they say.
All right, let's go to phone calls. We've got west of the Rockies, Linda in Auburn, Washington. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hello, Dave. Thank you for taking my call. I have some questions for your guest,
Certainly.
David Elkington. I first of all want to say I appreciate and admire your bravery, Mr. Elkington, in trying to get this truth out for us. And my question is, what did the codices text say about Jesus personally? Did it mention whether he was born in Egypt? And did it mention who the supposed chosen people are he's coming back for? Because the Muslims think they are the chosen ones, and the Jewish people think they are the chosen ones, and the Christians think they are. And did the codices mention Christianity per se, or anything about Christianity, or was that a man-made religion created by the Romans?
That's a really good question, and thank you so much for putting it, and thank you so much for your estimation of what we've been through. It's really appreciated.
Yes, thank you for calling in, Linda.
Going to your question, I have to say that I think that, you know, everybody thinks they're the chosen ones. I think that when you actually look at the tenets of Jesus and you abide by them, and we have a lot of the wisdom written on the codices, you find that not only was he a very remarkable man, he was a very moral man. I can understand why people would be drawn to him and feel that they have been chosen. I think that's a very critical point. In terms of the foundations of Christianity, the codices actually seem to be harking back to a much earlier period. And indeed, we believe that some of the codices, some of the thicker lead tablets, we think that they date back to the period of the Temple of Solomon. And this is curious because the codices show a building, they show menorah, they show palm trees, they show the messianic stars. We think, and this is a theory at the moment, but we think that they hark back to that period of Solomon before the religion of the Hebrews was changed, before it was actually altered, and therefore became effectively two religions much later on, those religions being Judaism and Christianity. So I think that what we have is we have Jesus on the codices trying to restore that which had been lost. I think that's the critical issue here. And I think that, you know, this is ongoing research. This seems to be confirmed by what the codices are saying, that Christianity was developed by the apostles in the aftermath of Jesus' mission, but that actually it was largely a restoration movement of that which had come before. So in other words, Christianity is a lot older than the first century period, and I think that a lot more is going to come out of this, and it's going to be quite dynamic. And I think that for Christians, this is something that should be celebrated. I think this is something that should be looked at with joy. And I think it's also good for the other two religions too, for Islam and for Judaism, because it takes us back to a point at which the three great religions hadn't yet divided, they hadn't separated. So what we've got here is something that could unify. And I think that's, personally, I think that's a really, really great thing.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Joe in Long Island, you're on Coast to Coast AM.
Yeah, hi, David. My question would be, what could we learn more from all this potentially about the Book of Revelation, particularly the earlier section where it references the messages to seven churches, such as Philadelphia? What have you learned about that that could shed light, and what could we potentially learn about the Book of Revelation that's still a mystery to unlock for many people?
Hi, Joe. It's great to speak with you. Yeah, I mean, Revelation's a really interesting book. It's the last book of the Bible. It's the one that famously mentions a little book carried by Jesus that has seven seals. And, of course, as he opens the seals, terrible things happen until the very end, of course, when the last seal is opened, and suddenly we have a vision of peace and of the New Jerusalem. I think that what we can learn about Revelation is that A, it's less a vision and more a historical document. It's a document that documents the survival of a much older theology than Christianity, but which became Christianity. And I think that in those terms, we've got something here which is very potent and very powerful. I think it's going to give us a huge insight into the development of the Christian religion in the aftermath of Jesus and the apostles. And I believe fundamentally that it will take away some of the more superstitious aspects of Revelation and offer us a much more logical path to an understanding of what happened in the first century.
All right, let's go wild card line to James in Florida. You're on Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, sir. Yeah, this could be something really, really huge. I mean, could be on to something. I mean, bigger than Disclosure. As you know, we're in the end times now, and it says that in the Bible that in the end times, the mystery of the world, mystery of life, mystery of the world will be revealed. And this is how it might happen. And because he's getting so much flack, it has to be that it's the spiritual underworld that is attacked. It doesn't want this to come out. And it's like another book, Fallen Saints, The Mystery of the World Solved. That's another book that's under attack like this one. And you may be onto something really, really big. And this researcher may actually be prophesied in the Bible. It's weird. I mean, we're in those times, you know?
I'm just curious, James, why do you say that these are the end times? You say it with such conviction.
I'm a screenwriter. I'm a screenwriter, and I studied the Book of Revelations under a private tutor for 7 years.
Okay.
And I worked on a script, and the only reason I didn't do the script is because I feel that I was shown that it's not a pre-tribulation rapture after I was almost done with the script, after all this study and everything. But I can tell you that the clock, what time it is, it's 5 till 12, sir. It's 5 till midnight in every way. In fact, the prophet John was shown a cluster of stars, and probably a lot of listeners know about this. The cluster of stars he was shown can only be seen by us here this September 23rd, 2017. And that's the same time that the 70 years of Israel become a nation comes to an end. And there's a lot of other things, too much for me to go into here just as one caller. But we are at the very, very end. I mean, trust me, just after years of studying this. And I'm just saying that this gentleman could be, he could be huge.
All right.
It's just interesting, you know.
Thank you, James. Did you have any comments on that, David?
Yeah, that's a fascinating observation. I personally think that, you know, we talk about end times, but we kind of don't look beyond the end. And I begin to wonder that, you know, after the end times, we have a kind of like a startup time again. It's like the end of a cycle and, the recovery of a new cycle. And we do have that in the Bible. We have in the Book of Daniel, we have the mention of 70 days of weeks. If we look at that in terms of actual time, we're talking here of a cycle of 490 years. And that seems to be a process that has been spoken about by a number of other scholars, you know, where a king would actually have to undergo a particular rite or ritual within the temple itself in Jerusalem. Now, of course, the temple is very central to the codices. It's basically what the codices are centered around. And if we read the Gospels properly, Jesus, too, centers himself around the temple. The most famous events in the Gospels are all centered in or around the temple. So when we speak about the end times, I think we have to be very careful to see that actually what we're looking at here is the end of a cycle. A bit like the Mayan prophecies that talked about the end of one cycle, the beginning of another. You know, and I think it's something that actually occurs quite regularly in religions across the world.
All right, let's try to squeeze in one quick call. First-time caller, Anne in Jacksonville, Florida. Quick question before we run out of time.
Yes, hi. Actually, I've been listening to these questions, and thank you very much, Mr. Elkington, and your host. Thank you so much. But let me just go ahead and quickly say that I was interested in finding out what if you had gotten any information from the tablets. These questions that I had were pretty much already addressed. I guess I stayed on so I could listen, but I wanted to say thank you very much. And I will follow the Facebook page. And
great.
What do you think about the possibility of there being any kind of, I know this is a little left field, but any kind of lineage carried down of Christ?
Thank you for calling in, Anne. Go ahead.
Could you repeat that?
She just wondered if you believe that there might be a lineage that's been carried down from Christ.
Ah, right.
The bloodline, right.
Now, yes. Well, I mean, that's a possibility. We'd have to look into the codices and see, you know, what they say. I can neither confirm nor deny that, because simply we haven't looked at that side of it yet. But obviously, if we do come up with something that suggests that, then, of course, we will actually announce it. But it's an interesting question, because there's been a lot of debate over that recently, you know, whether Jesus was married, whether he had children, etc. Personally speaking, my own view of it was that Jesus was a Nazarene, and Nazarenes were actually sworn to celibacy. And I think, therefore, that it's unlikely that he was married, although I'm not dismissing the possibility. There is a female aspect of the divine mentioned on the codices, the figure of wisdom, who was also known as the Lost Lady in Jerusalem. And Jesus on the central codex is mentioned in terms of the way he is mentioned in the New Testament as a bridegroom. So it might well be that the whole idea of Jesus and the feminine is a spiritual thing, because wisdom, if we look at the figure of wisdom in the Bible, in both the Old and the New Testament, wisdom is given quite some credit.
Thank you, David. We're up against the top of the hour. We've got links up for you. People can follow up with your Facebook page. Stay tuned. We've got more of the best in overnight talk radio coming your way here on Coast to Coast AM.